Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Nicholas Cole talking about understanding the US government.
Thank you very much. It really is a great honour to be here. This is what Madison said about the founding of his nation when he was trying to persuade the people of New York to ratify the Constitution that he and his colleagues had taken 3 months to write. He said, "It's frequently been remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country to decide that important question, whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice." He was being rude about the British, of course, because the British government is not founded on the basis of reflection and choice. The British government is founded through a series of historical accidents and changes that have accrued over time. This is a really good day to be giving this talk because yesterday the Supreme Court made all of its major rulings before its summer holidays. And so we get to see some of the people who think that they have the last word in America making their mind up about a whole series of issues. So we discovered this morning when we woke up that the federal government, the federal courts, were not going to interfere in partisan gerrymandering because it's a matter for the states to work out how electoral districts should be distributed. We found out that if you're unconscious in your car and your state has passed a law allowing it, the police will be allowed to take blood from you without a warrant. And we discovered that the 2020 census can't include a question on citizenship. And these were all questions that were considered by the Supreme Court, and their decision on these matters is more or less final for now. Americans have a very strange relationship with their constitution from British eyes. So this is Barack Obama giving a speech, one of his first big policy speeches in America, where he felt the need to go to the National Archives and literally stand in front of the Constitution. And the reason he felt he had to go and do that was that he wanted to say that closing Guantanamo Bay would be the constitutionally correct thing to do. Every day in Congress, American politicians are forced to ask, what would our founders do on this policy question? Because America is, of course, a government of limited powers. The sovereign powers in America do not have an unlimited right to do whatever they wish. All of the various governments can only do those things that have been delegated to them expressly. And so there was the sight as well of Obama's attorney general going to the Supreme Court to argue that Obamacare, some technical changes to the rules under which insurance is offered for health care in the United States, that this was really what James Madison would have meant by the Commerce Clause, which is slightly strange from a British point of view, because we don't say, well, there's a health crisis in the NHS, what would Pitt the Younger do? So this room, then, where the Constitution was written, turns out to be incredibly important in deciding modern policy questions of all kinds. And the controversies about what the people who were in that room one very hot summer in 1787 were trying to do frequently make the national press. So there was a spat this spring between two American scholars about whether the Electoral College, the mechanism that had created the Donald Trump presidency, had its origins in a pro-slavery ploy or not. A spat, actually, that ran as well in 2001, after the 2000 election. Well, what did that convention that met that summer, those 55 people who wrote the convention, what did they actually achieve? Maybe it's best to start there. America can make a very strong claim that their system of government is one of the first proofs that you can actually negotiate a system of government. This has become very standard in the modern world. It's since 1787, most states, though not all, have adopted some kind of convention process when they're deciding how they should be governed. And the Americans really got there first. This was their invention. Secondly, they avoided a binary choice between federalism as it had been understood, a union of just sovereign states and a single national government. They actually blurred the question of sovereignty, and that blurring would eventually cause a civil war. But at that particular moment, they didn't jump one way or the other. They did something that European political thought and their own American political thought said was impossible, and they created a sort of system of split sovereignty, where the individual states would continue to be in many ways sovereign, but the federal government would also be understood as sovereign. And lastly, they managed by 1789, when they got the constitution ratified, to really close off questions about whether republican government was the right way forward for America, and really close out a period of experimentation in mechanisms of government. The Americans have not overturned what they did. They live very much with the same constitution today. But they left many things unclear. They had a strict commitment in words to a separation of powers. That was one of the very first things they agreed, that there would be a separate legislative, executive, and judicial branch. But they didn't really say how that would work, and they didn't really flesh out the judicial branch very much at all. Constitutionally, all that is required is that America should have a Supreme Court with a Chief Justice. Even the numbers of judges on that court are not defined in the Constitution, and the lesser courts are not defined either. They can all be changed in legislation. Nor did they define the exact boundary of power between the states and the national government, nor how these boundaries should be policed. And of course, they didn't settle the question, which has a new resonance for us, I think, of whether under what circumstances states could leave. What do we know about what went on? Well, there was a secretary of the convention called William Jackson, who was paid an extraordinary sum for keeping what historians have subsequently called careless records. They're careless because they don't contain any of the things historians really want to know. They're a very formal record of the debates. They often don't say who spoke on particular issues. They just say what was proposed and what was agreed and what was rejected. And he does that job as the official secretary. He gave it to Washington and left it with Congress, but we also know that he destroyed most of the other paperwork. We've got this nice letter from Jackson in September 1787, where he says, "I've just burned most of the papers that historians would like, and I'll be dropping round the journal to you later this evening." We also have a series of unofficial diaries, including one kept by James Madison, who does record precis of most of the speeches. This didn't become available to the American public until 1840. So in fact, for most of the early period of America's history, most people didn't know what had gone on at the convention at all. Eventually, this would be published really in the edition we use today in the early 20th century. If you go and turn to the journal, there's a curious formality about the proceedings. This is the second day of real debate, and this is what the official journal says. It says that the House resolved itself into a committee of the whole to consider the state of the American Union. Now, what would have happened then is Washington would have been sitting in the chair, he would have stood up, somebody else would have taken the chair. They then did the day's business, and at the end of that day, the president of the Committee of the Whole asks that they pass a resolution that they'd like to meet again tomorrow. They pass that resolution. He gets out of the chair. Washington gets back into it. Washington agrees that they can indeed meet tomorrow. And then the next day, they review that and check that that's what they agreed yesterday. It is a curiously formal kind of occasion. And it doesn't make any sense unless you realize that a lot of them have read a work published a century earlier in England called the Lex Parlamentaria, where it says if you've got a really serious bit of business to discuss, form yourself into a committee of the whole, but you can't adjourn yourself. You have to ask every day for meetings. So they're following this 100-year-old parliamentary procedure, and that's what Jackson is taking care to note down. He's not noting down the speeches, he's noting down carefully that they follow this kind of procedure. So the records look beautiful. and the handwriting is lovely, but it's incredibly hard to understand. So if we drop into a random day, does it really help you to know that Mr. Gerry and Mr. Sherman moved to insert after the words "publish them" the following, except that relate to treaties and operations? They have a text in front of them that William Jackson is keeping for them, that they're editing the whole time, and we don't have access to that. So they could have asked at any point for what they've agreed to be read out, and we don't have access to that, which makes the minutes very hard to follow. So the process of writing the Constitution was hard to understand, or is hard to understand, because it's very complicated. It involves a lot of record keeping, and the parliamentary procedures they're following, which have their roots in the 17th or even 16th century in England, are unfamiliar to us now. Let me just give you a taste of the very first day of debate, when they've not even agreed anything very much, and don't worry about following the text. So, Mr. Randolph, we're told, moved the resolution that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned according to quotas of contribution or a number of free inhabitants or one or other rule. And what that means is that he's suggesting that the people who will actually draw up the constitution in about 2 months' time, when it goes to another subcommittee, will be able to choose between either saying, well, the states will be represented according to how much they pay or according to the number of the free inhabitants. I'll just give you a flavour of how that debate goes down. That resolution had been introduced the previous day in a long list of potential resolutions called the Virginia Plan. And just before this, they just about managed to agree without arguing that the national government ought to consist of an executive, judiciary and legislative branch. So they've agreed one sentence. So Madison immediately says, well, the words, the number of free inhabitants, is going to annoy people, so could we strike them out? Because, of course, many states owned slaves at the time. Could we strike them out and just say quotas of contribution? So states will be represented according to how much they pay. That immediately gets an objection that, well, that's going to change all the time, so that would make American government really uncertain. So Hamilton said, well, let's agree then that it should be the number of free inhabitants, which, of course, Madison, as a slave owner, would have bristled at. So we already see a bit of a row between Hamilton and Madison. So then they say, well, let's not decide that for now. Then they say, well, should we agree that there ought to be a proportional representation of the states rather than one state each, which would have given this wording? And then somebody said, well, can we add on to that, and not according to the present system, because the present system that they were reforming was not proportioned. That's agreed, but then it was moved that the wording should be changed just to read this. Then they said, well, let's not decide that either. And then they say, well, what about this completely alternative wording? Which introduces the idea of an equitable ratio, which is as vague as it sounds. And then somebody says, look, if we carry on like this, we'll never get anywhere. So they finish the first day by postponing all of that, and they've agreed one sentence, which was frustrating. And all of that's really hard to follow. So many generations have decided it would be much easier if we just imagine the American Constitution as having been written by one chap. So here we are. Here is a statue of George Washington writing the American Constitution, because it's just easier to imagine that. This was struck by lightning almost immediately, which I rather like. The Wikipedia page says, well, let's think about this as there being essentially four plans presented at the convention, and those four plans resulted in a compromise constitution. And that's quite good, except for two things. First of all, three of the plans were never properly debated at all. Two of the plans, we don't even quite know what they said because the records don't survive. And, you know, fundamentally, this is just not the way these things happen in practice. The other problem with this is that if you give those, if you give the two main plans to a group of bright 15-year-olds and say, find a compromise between these two things, they do it in about 40 minutes. So then the question is, well, what was the convention doing for the remaining 3 months? So some people have said, well, let's try metaphor instead. So this is quite a good website if you're teaching history to students, teachingamericanhistory.org, and they write up the convention as a three-act play, just to help you understand what's going on. But what we did in Oxford instead was we thought, well, could we model the negotiations? Could we take these very formal records and the manuals of parliamentary practice that we knew they were using, and could we construct a computer model of what they did? Could we, in other words, divide the things that go on into a series of event types that the computer could understand? So relatively few things can actually happen in a parliamentary process. People can gain or lose a right to speak. People can introduce text for discussion, which they can then propose amending or not. Decisions can be taken, and there can be arguments about procedure. You know, everything we did yesterday was invalid because we didn't write it properly in the minutes or whatever. And if you build this kind of model and you feed the minutes of the convention in, what you can actually build up is a timeline of the events, and you can start to really show people what's actually happening. So this is the committee structure of the convention. You can see here the way documents, each brown little icon, each parchment little icon is a new document being written without the amendments, and you can see how it gets passed between various subcommittees for debate. What that lets us do, really importantly, is we can drop into any individual moment now, any individual place where a decision is being taken or a bit of wording is being proposed, and we can show you down the left-hand side of the screen the stack of paperwork that's available. We can show you in the middle of the screen the wording that would have been read out by the secretary if anybody had asked him to read out, well, what have we agreed? And then we can put other tools online as well, on the right. And when you map it all out like that, the convention is an incredibly complicated process with over 2,700 individual proposals made and decisions taken to write about 4,500 words of text, which does give you a sense of just how much care they put in to almost every pair of words. We can do statistical analysis as well to show you alliances. We can show you the contributions of different delegations. We can pick out all the places where individuals make a contribution and all of that kind of thing. We struggled for a while with the visuals, because obviously this is a very visual project. And for a long time, we had the idea of a timeline going left to right that people quite liked. And then we could show you the hierarchical structure of a debate in a committee. So we could show you that each committee considered a series of documents, each of those documents had a series of amendments proposed, each of those amendments could be amended, and so on and so forth. But it was really hard to link the two. And in the end, we took inspiration from music to try and come up with a display that would let us link both sequence and relationship, and so built these kinds of displays that sort of give you a sense of how committee work really works on a sort of day-by-day basis. So, I thought it would be fun to see what they were doing on this day in history in 1787. So I looked it up, and it's actually quite a fun day. Not a lot happens. Is it good or bad? Let's find out. Well, one of the things that happens that's very famous is that Franklin proposes to alter the orders of business to add daily prayers, because they haven't made enough progress. And he says, if we don't start praying, we're never going to get anywhere. Now, we can see why he said that, because at that particular moment, they had been working for a little over 2 months, and they'd agreed exactly that amount of text. A few hundred words at most. If we step back to see what had just happened immediately before Franklin said, well, we better start praying every day, the proposal that prompted that was somebody suggesting removing the word not from one clause. And that removal of that single word, which again was about how states should be represented in Congress, threatened to grind the whole thing to a halt. They don't end up having daily prayers because nobody can agree how much they should pay the priest. That's all in the records. So we can then go through this and we can tag particular things. I won't go through it now because of time, but we got phone calls last, December 2016, with people asking us about the Electoral College, which is an incredibly technical aspect of the American Constitution, and suddenly America was really interested in why it was created. So we've gone through and we've tagged all of the discussion on the Electoral College with comment about why different proposals for selecting the president were considered or rejected. But that's only half the story. Because I should also say that, and I'm sorry the text's been cut off at the top, I should also say that not everybody, even in the founding generation, thought that the achievement was a good one. Thomas Jefferson said later, after he'd been president, that if control of the government by the people was a good measure of republicanism, and he confessed he knew no other measure, that in fact America's federal politicians had removed popular control from too many aspects of the government. Thank you. And this problem of who controls the boundary between the federal government and the state governments, and who controls who's in charge of what, is actually a really difficult one. It might be the Supreme Court, as we saw at the beginning of this lecture. The Supreme Court think that they are the primary guardians of this. But they're not the only possibilities. Congress as well has a role in refusing to pass legislation that it thinks is unconstitutional, that it thinks is going too far. And many in the founding generation thought that, and they used to have a committee to consider exactly that question. Would the legislation we're considering be constitutional? The presidency is given a veto, according to some commentators, not because George III had one, so Washington had to have one, but so that the president could veto unconstitutional legislation. It wasn't just legislation that he didn't like. It was, according to some commentators, legislation that was unconstitutional. The state legislatures themselves have a role in saying what is and isn't constitutional, although if you push that too far, the union unravels. State governors also make representations on this question, and state constitutions themselves make claims and counterclaims about where the limits of their authority go. And that leads me to the question of state constitutions, because America has 50 states, but they've had many more state constitutions than that. Between 1776 and 1861 alone, there were 70 state constitutions written, not including constitutions written by native peoples, and not including constitutions that were written but never went into effect. And since 1776, there have been 235 completely separate constitutions in force at state level in America. And somebody asked me before this talk, well, what's your major message about understanding American government? And my major message is, it's really complicated. And for all the work that's been done at federal level, we know much less about the state constitutions. So there are only three major reference works. The first two are still cited by the Supreme Court. The second one, by Thorpe, would definitely not pass a plagiarism examination. But think of the dates when they're writing them. The Poor and Thorpe records were written by the editors writing round the state governments and saying, could you send us a copy of your constitution? And that was pretty much as much due diligence as they were able to do. There was a project at the University of Maryland to try and just get the final text straight of every constitution that had been in effect in America since the founding. That project ran for 5 years and it failed. I mean, they've got a note on their website, we came as close as we could, but if you actually want to know what constitutional law was in effect in America at a particular date, we don't actually currently have the tools to know, which is extraordinary because these texts define what is and isn't legal for the government to do. They define everything from whether there'll be a lottery to how divorce will work, how will land law work, how will water rights work, and so on. As well as all of the other things that you might think of. And the fact that we don't really know exactly what texts were in effect is quite astonishing. So this is where the story takes a really interesting turn for me, because we were setting up the project on the federal records, and this university in Utah called Utah Valley University phoned up and said, we've just set up a Center for Constitutional Studies and we'd love to do a project. Do you have any ideas? Now, Pembroke College, Oxford is 400 years old and Utah Valley University isn't. And Pembroke College, Oxford is one of the most highly selective places of education in the world. And Utah Valley University is a really interesting institution. It's open enrollment. So anybody who wants to go can go, and the fees are really low. So I went over and I said, actually, that would be really interesting. So what I asked some students there to do was go into their state archives and look at how their state constitution had been written in 1895. And I don't really have time to go through their work, but it is incredible, and it will be cited at the state Supreme Court starting this autumn. And I should say as well that the lead students on that project come from the most amazingly diverse backgrounds. There's an illegal immigrant and a former hairdresser and a lady who was kicked out of home by her parents and so on. And they've done an incredible amount of work over the course of about 3 years, just to work out how Utah's constitution was written. Now, this was the map of the committee structure at the federal level for the 1787 convention. One of the interesting things about the state constitutions is that if I'd known how complicated they were, I would never have asked students at UVU to start looking into them. But like everybody else at the time, I thought that state constitutional conventions were less interesting. Here is just a fraction of the same diagram for the 1895 convention. And we don't think that Utah is the most complicated. We think it's about middle of the road in terms of its complexity. So there is an enormous body of work to be done on why the state constitutional texts that we have were written this way. And I'm incredibly proud of this work and being able to work with such incredible young people to do it. So where does this all leave us? Well, there was a case decided last week, which I think shows up some of the problems of American government, in microcosm. Here is a memorial cross to fallen soldiers in Maryland. It is on state land. I thought it would be appropriate, not only because it was last week, but because of the broader theme of this festival. So this monument has been there since the early 20th century. But an objection was raised that it breached the separation of church and state. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that it's a state monument on state land. And the First Amendment to the Constitution says very clearly, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, you might think that setting up a cross is establishing religion or state support for religion, and we could debate exactly that point, but there's another point as well, which is that the first word of the First Amendment is Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say anything about whether the state of Maryland can make a law respecting the establishment of religion, so why on earth should the Supreme Court think they can get involved? Well, they think that because of these words in the 14th Amendment passed after the Civil War. And it's these words that are actually behind almost all of the cases that you will hear about in the news. Not the work in 1787, but the work in 1787 read through these much later words, which say, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty and property without due process of law, or deny to any person the equal jurisdiction of the laws. And what the Supreme Court has done is said, well, nobody bothered to define what the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States are. But could we read this kind of language as a guide? So it says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Maybe what this amendment means is that we should read the First Amendment as if it also applied to the states. And that lets us interfere in state policy as well. That is the history of the Supreme Court in the 20th century in a nutshell. It works with the Second Amendment as well. The Second Amendment, which prohibits Congress from infringing the right to keep and bear arms, read through this amendment, might give the Supreme Court the power to say that no state is allowed to regulate whether or not you can keep a gun or what kind of gun you're allowed to have in America. And it's the interaction of these texts that are incredibly brief that actually creates all of the interesting constitutional questions. And again, there isn't a good resource for how those words were written. So we're working on that too, and that should be out before Christmas, we hope. But this cross in microcosm explains why American government is so incredibly complicated. Because what this cross tells you is that even if you write down very clearly who's responsible for what matters most is the interpretation of it all. And in America, you have three different branches of government operating in 50 different states and at federal level as well, all making claims about what they can and can't do, and with very uncertain arrangements sometimes for who should get to make the final decision. So, people in this country often say they'd like a written constitution. And I often wonder, what exactly is the feature of a written constitution that they really want? I think some people say they want a written constitution because if they think if we all just sat in a room for 3 months, one hot summer, we'd come up with something more rational. Well, I work on what they did that summer quite a lot, and I have my doubts, but okay. Maybe we could come up with something more orderly and logical. Would there be merit, and this is a harder question, in making the Constitution harder to change? I very carefully not mentioned Trump in this talk so far. But let's just talk about contemporary politics for a moment. The Lib Dems and the Conservatives made a very small constitutional change a few years ago with the Fixed Term Parliament Act. And they did exactly what the writers of political science textbooks have been saying since at least the 1970s should be done, and they fixed elections so that we know when each election is going to happen. And what that Fixed Term Parliament Act has done this year is create something that the British Constitution is not really able to deal with, which is a zombie government unable to get its own legislation through. And before that act, it seems pretty clear to me that the government would have fallen, but after that act, which was just a small technical change to one bit of our constitution, it's completely changed a whole series of other things and the relationship of the executive to parliament and many, many other things. But I think there's a more profound philosophical point if you make constitutions very hard to change. And the American constitution at federal level is incredibly hard to change. There have been 27 amendments, 10 of those are the Bill of Rights, so there have really been fewer than 20 times when the Constitution has been changed in 200 years. Now, that works very well if you think that injustice occurs because of hasty action. And many injustices do occur because of hasty action. But injustice can also occur because of delay. And the big question that the American Constitution was completely unable to deal with was the question of slavery. If South Carolina had not left the Union in 1860 and 1861, and there had not been a civil war, it's very, very hard to see how America would have entered the 20th century without slaves. Remember, other states in South America still have slavery at the time. Mexico only ends slavery through imperial edict in 1888. There's no constitutional mechanism to end slavery because the Constitution set up in 1787 makes it so difficult. So sometimes making things hard to change results in justice and sometimes injustice, and I wouldn't like to say which as a general rule. Does having a written constitution provide clarity? Well, I think we've seen that the answer to that in the American case is no, it doesn't provide clarity, but it may shift decision-making to other bodies than the legislative body. It may shift decision-making to judges and Supreme Courts. Do written constitutions provide the right incentives for people making legislation? I think that's an even trickier question, actually, because it might be that written constitutions, at least with very strict bills of rights, provide exactly the reverse incentive. There are many, many instances where the legislative bodies of the states pass legislation that is popular but deeply unconstitutional, not because they think that legislation will really go into effect, because they know the Supreme Court is going to stop them, but so that they can say they've passed it. And if you set up a system where people are trying to pass laws that they don't ever think are going to go into effect to rally their base, what you end up doing is polarizing politics rather horribly and not encouraging sensible legislation. And this is a massive problem at state level and to a certain extent at federal level as well. So I'm going to finish, and then we've plenty of time for questions, by considering carefully the following question. Is America's Constitution fit for purpose? Well, at state level, things change incredibly frequently. The next constitution that the students at Utah would really like to go on and look at is the Illinois Constitution of 1972, and they picked that as the thing they wanted to work on with us next because they were really intrigued by the idea of looking at a constitution writing process that had been that involved people who were still alive. So they're really interested to go and interview the people that are involved. State constitutions change all the time. In fact, state constitutions in terms of their amendments change almost annually. One of the reasons for that is that in the early 20th century, in the progressive era, the progressives thought that allowing the people to change the constitutions that they had by direct popular vote would result in better government. And the result is, if you collect the right number of signatures in California, you can write whatever you like into the state's constitution, and that happens almost every single year. Many things in the federal constitution are based on 18th century assumptions about the state, and it strikes me as I travel around America that in some places those assumptions work much better than in other places. So the 18th century idea of the relationship of the citizen and the state is one where there's a great deal more personal privacy and the state really stays out of your business as much as possible. That's the sort of 18th century model. And that works really well in rural parts of America or less dense urban parts of America. And if you go there, you'll see there's almost no CCTV. The mechanisms of government seem incredibly light. It's very, very hard, though, to see that those assumptions about government fit very well in dense metropolitan environments, where you're trying to manage the traffic flow of thousands, if not millions, of people moving around, where you need an infrastructure to be able to say, well, we know what our citizens are up to, and we're going to start using AI to predict what they're going to do next, and we're going to, you know, use the surveillance systems of the state, not for nefarious purposes necessarily, but simply to manage a very difficult population. But there's another problem too, and I've been alluding to it all the way through my remarks. Many, many, many aspects that Americans thought or think still are regarded as settled and are in, and as part of their constitution as they study it in school are in fact convention rather than law. And this is where we do need to talk about Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump doesn't care. He doesn't care what's been done in the past. He just wants to know, am I allowed in a black letter way to do X or Y? Or he doesn't even know to ask the question. And so what this has done is meant that many, many conventions about how the presidency should relate to Congress or whether the president needs to answer queries by Congress have simply been ignored. Congress is asking the president for documentation, which previous administrations, even administrations that had rather strained relationships with the law in various ways, would have honoured. The Trump administration have just said, well, we're not going to do that. Make us. And of course, Congress can't physically make them. But that goes a long way down, and it goes right back to the American founding. I can give you an example from the 18th century. The Constitution says that the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall make treaties. Well, the Senate in 1789 was 26 people and felt very much like a sort of advisory council to the president, or might have done. So George Washington, who'd negotiated some treaties with native peoples, thought he'd go along to the Senate for their advice. So he walked in and he read out the documents and he said, I'm here for your advice. And everybody sat around awkwardly, and then somebody said, well, Mr. President, we'd like to send this off to a subcommittee. I think I've told you they're very into subcommittees. So Washington said, well, what do you mean? I'm right here. We could talk about it now. And that first Congress said, no, we're not going to do that because we believe in the separation of the branches of government. So we're going to talk about it first, and then we'll send a delegation to you. Well, Washington got extremely cross and stormed out. And no president ever since has gone to discuss a treaty with the Senate. They have done it all by writing, but that's merely a convention. And I could go on and on and on. So although textbooks love to tell you that America has a written constitution and we don't, this isn't really true. America's constitution is every bit as bound by convention as ours. Then the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights at federal level is a set of 10 amendments passed very quickly in 1789 as the price of union. But it was written to restrict the federal government from doing certain things, not in the amount of detail of, say, the European Convention of Human Rights or the French Rights of Man and the Citizen of the same period or other such documents. So it's actually a very short document without any of the exemptions or points of detail that you would really expect in a Bill of Rights. And it could be that way because it was never going to apply generally to America. It was only going to apply as a set of restrictions for the federal government. Well, since the 14th Amendment and since the Supreme Court has started to read this very, very short Bill of Rights as a guide to what they may or may not allow at state level, the Bill of Rights text looks worse and worse as a statement of rights, because in fact it gives enormous freedom to the federal courts to actually make up policy in the gaps that really aren't covered. Because it's clearly the case that there should be some restriction on weaponry. I mean, it seems obvious to everybody that I shouldn't be allowed to drive off with a tank, even though I really want to. So what does keep and bear arms mean? Somebody's got to flesh it out, but it's not going to come out of the text. It's going to come out of 9 people at the Supreme Court deciding what they think the right thing to do is. And one of the problems with that is that the Supreme Court is not supposed to be a policy-making body and doesn't have a policy-making staff. So when the Obamacare Act was in front of the Supreme Court, and it's an enormous body of legislation, the Supreme Court actually said, do you really expect us to have read all of this in open hearing? And they were ruling on whether or not it was legal. They simply don't have the staff to do the policy making that they're now in fact doing. And the last thing, and I think this should trouble us on both sides of the Atlantic, is that even written constitutions can do very little if they don't sit in healthy political cultures. And I think we know how to study institutions and we know how to study the history of law, but I don't think we really understand the broader political culture nearly as well, and we don't understand why some things are just culturally acceptable or not acceptable. Is it acceptable to lie in politics about something serious and keep your job? We've had a convention in Britain and America for about 150 years that's not all right. But it's not really as old as you think, and I'm not really sure why it came into being. And I'm not sure at all what will happen if we lose it, if it becomes okay to go to Parliament and lie without consequence, then I don't know how any constitution, written or unwritten, would survive that. So the answer to, is America's constitution fit for purpose, is, well, at state level, America's constitutions have evolved all the time. I expect them to change more in the future. It's the federal constitution where this question becomes tricky. It has held together a union on the basis of a series of compromises made in 1787. It has held together a union of very diverse states. And some of those compromises sometimes upset people, because one of the most fundamental compromises, and this does go to Trump's election, is that the votes of rural voters in less populous states count more than the votes of urban populations in densely populated states. And that is a compromise that goes all the way back to the founding and comes out in many aspects of the text. But it is an awkward compromise for the modern day. I don't think the Bill of Rights is really fit for purpose. But having said that, I don't see any real prospect that it will change.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.